Sewer Division. Probably one of the roughest investigations, if you're assigned to burglary, you'll find that it's a lot of work, frustrating work. One of the most difficult assignments. Bill's done a real fine job on behalf of the department in running a real good tight ship down there and getting a, at least trying to stay abreast of the situation with the rise in crime and so forth. Been with the department for a number of years, and worked just about all facets of the department. And if you have the fortune of, good fortune of working under Captain Mankey, I'm sure that you'll find it exciting and probably frustrating, but you'll have a lot of work piled ahead and shoulders above, regardless of how you stand. Captain Mankey.
Thank you, Carl. Well, greetings and welcome to all you future detectives. I understand that most of you have filed the application for the test. Well, in discussing burglary investigation, or any discussion that one has, I think it's well to go back and get a little background on it. And in the field of criminal law, there's a great deal of background. Most of you may well be familiar with the fact that our law stems from the common law, and it goes back to England, to the common law of England. And the common law began in England somewhere around 600 A.D. That was the first beginnings of the common law at the time of the Iberians and the Celts in England. It gradually developed over a period of time. And it wasn't until about the 12th century in England that statutes were first developed as we have a concept of them today. In other words, statutes that were passed by a central governmental body. Prior to the 12th century, it was just simply a matter of one person against another. If one man stole from the second party, it was up to the second party to redress his wrongs. It was a matter of just conflict between the two. In the 12th century, when these first statutes were passed, then it became a crime against the state, which in that case was the state of England, or the government of England. Well, we have the same situation today. Crimes that are committed, they're not committed against the individual, basically, or legally, they're committed against the state. And that's why we have a state prosecution. We have a prosecutor. These statutes are passed by the legislature, and it's a state prosecution rather than a matter of one individual fighting against another or attempting to redress his own wrong. Originally, the term burglary came to us pretty much from the German, two German words. One of them was the word Burgess, which means a house in German. And the second word is Leran, which means thief. And you add the two together, and we have in English the word burglary. In the early English common law, and as it was brought over to the colonies and continued for some time after the colonies were united, the judicial interpretation of the crime of burglary was limited to the breaking and entering into the house of another in the nighttime with intent to commit a felony. All right, if you compare that against our present statutes, you'll see that today our statutes are much more broad than what the early concept of it was. Going back to that time, it was merely the entering into a house. It had to be a dwelling. And it had to be in the nighttime and with the intent to commit a felony. But you will notice as we continue our discussion here that there were three elements to this crime even at that time. There was the breaking and the entering, the nighttime, and the intent to commit a felony. And basically, that's exactly what our statutes cover today. There are basically three elements of the crime of burglary. Recently, there's been further modification and changes in our statutes on burglary, not only here in Minnesota, but in other states. And it's changed now so that it includes not only the dwelling house, but include other structures, buildings. Almost any type of a building is included in the statute on burglary. In some states, it includes boats, it includes railroad cars. These are specifically mentioned in the statute. Our statutes here in Minnesota have been further modified recently since 1963, as most of you know, whereby it does not have to be in the nighttime. It applies equally either daytime or nighttime. So, whether it's in Minnesota or whatever state you might be in, you'd have to check your local statutes to find out exactly what the elements are of the particular crime you're concerned with. Now, burglary is primarily a crime against property, as distinguished from that of a crime against the person. However, it's quite frequently it's aggravated by other acts, such as robbery and rape and murder. Most of you remember here not too long ago when Gossett was rambling at large, he was committing burglaries, and once he got into the house, he also committed rapes and other indecent acts. It's one of the most prevalent crimes. In 1963, some of you may have seen the yearly FBI uniform crime reports that are come out. In 1963, there were 975,900 burglaries committed in the United States. And according to the I didn't figure this out myself, but according to the statistics, it says that that means a burglary was committed every 32 seconds. Well, the way the reports keep coming in here, I think, by golly, we're topping that most of the time. You probably remember recently a article in the Minneapolis Star, and it noted there that burglaries in 1964 were up 35% over 1963. So as you all know from working out on the streets, we're having a lot of them. Burglary actually is one of the most difficult investigations that we have. Now that may sound a little bit odd to you, but if you get around the country in other cities and you talk with police personnel, you talk with prosecutors, you'll find that there's almost unanimous agreement that it is difficult. And there are several reasons why. First of all, at the present time, generally there's a lack of method of operation on the part of the burglars. Now, time was in the past, back several years ago, when we had such people as Jimmy Valentine and a few other so-called expert safe burglars operating. They developed just one technique. And they continued until they were apprehended. They served a prison term. They got back out. They knew this one technique, so they went right back in business, continued to use this same technique. Well, that made it a little bit more readily, the police more readily able to apprehend them, because it was just a matter of waiting till they got out. They saw this same type of case coming in with the same technique. They knew just about who to look for again. But nowadays, we don't have that. The burglars today, that are operating currently at least, they might be a burglar tonight, tomorrow or next week. They might be a robber. A week after that, they might commit a theft. They're readily adaptable. They change. Whatever is a good deal comes along, it looks like an opportunity to make a fast buck. They get with a different group of friends. They go out and commit a different type of crime. They also watch television, probably as much as we do, if not more. They read the papers. They have the advantage of pretty good legal advice much of the time. They know now pretty much how police operate. So they make a deliberate effort to try to change their method of operation periodically. The purpose being to try to confuse the police as much as they possibly can. There's many of them that come through here when they're caught. Their concern is not primarily the fact that they're apprehended. Their concern is, well, what did they do wrong that caused the police to catch them? Because they're concerned next time they don't want to make that same mistake. So that's one of the reasons why it is a difficult type of crime to investigate and to bring to a successful conclusion. Another factor is that the majority of these crimes are committed at night under the cover of darkness. And tied in with that is the fact that almost always there are no witnesses. There is the exception to the rule, and it's always real nice when we do have a witness, but it's a rarity. So we've got to function in other ways to compensate for that. Another factor involved in the difficulty is the time lapse between the commission of the crime and the time of discovery. Now, you all know that it's just a rule of thumb in police work that the more quickly a crime is discovered, the fresher the clue, so to speak, the better off you're going to be in running your investigation. In burglary, as many of you know, there's a time lapse of anywhere from a matter of 5 minutes to as much as 5 days. And I'm sure that all of you here have run into situations where the individual didn't report it or maybe didn't discover it for a matter of several days. Another factor involved is the distance that these individuals travel to commit the crime of burglary. We've got people right here in town who travel to North and South Dakota. They pull a job on over a weekend or two or three. They're back in town here by Monday morning. They go down to Wisconsin, go up northern Minnesota, other counties, down in Iowa. It's a very simple thing. They're doing it all the time. They're strange down there. The police don't know them. They don't know their cars. They have a friend or two in these towns who maybe set the thing up for them. They come in, they hit, and they're gone. It works the same way in reverse. We have people coming in here from Chicago and other cities. They have a local friend who sets the job up. They fly in or come in by some other means of transportation. They make the score. They settle up with a guy, and away they go. Nobody, none of us at least, know they're ever in town. Another factor is their ability to travel distances to dispose of stolen property. And again, pretty much the same thing applies. If we can recover stolen property, that provides a very good lead. But unfortunately, much of this property is being transported out of town. Much of it goes to St. Paul. Some of it goes up to cities in the northern part of the state. Here about a year ago, we had an individual who was sending a great deal of it up to an area north of Duluth. It was going out to a small resort there, across the lake and onto an island. When the sheriff's office up in St. Louis County finally got a search warrant, they found boatloads of the stuff out there. As a result of that, we arrested a man down here in Minneapolis for them. But as happens every once in a while, when he come to trial, the court ruled that the search warrant was improper, so the whole thing was thrown out. Another factor is the prevalence and availability of scientific devices, such as radio and so forth, to assist the burglars in avoiding capture. And that's going on right here today in this town, the same as it is in other cities. They equip themselves with radios in their car, their portable jobs. They monitor our broadcasts. As soon as the call goes out to the squad, these characters know about it. They can hop in their cars and away they go, and they're long gone from the scene by the time the squad gets there. They also equip themselves with walkie-talkies. The lookout has one set. One man inside the place has another. And the lookout keeps him informed as to cars and activity in the area. Another factor, and a very important one also, is the fact that the crime of burglary must be proved almost entirely by circumstantial evidence. And this ties in with the fact that we generally have no witnesses. In many types of crime, now homicide for one, that's a glamorous type of thing, so-called, for a policeman or a detective. A lot of detectives, oh, they want to work in homicide. Sure, it's the papers build it up and so forth, but basically it's not a difficult investigation at all. Because first of all, the minute you get the body identified, that body provides an excellent witness. It gives you all kinds of leads, just oceans of them, that you can start checking out. So you have, in a homicide, you have a very minimum of one witness, which most of the time you don't have in burglary. The same thing in forgery. There you're going to have a minimum of one witness, the person who cashes the forged check. In larceny, generally, not always, but generally, you'll have a witness. That applies to almost every other type of crime. In robbery, you have the same thing. There, again, you've got a minimum of one witness, the person who is held up. In burglary, you don't have that. Your victim is either asleep or he's gone. He comes home and he finds his place of business burglarized or his home burglarized. So you start, in most cases, you start almost from nothing. These are just some of the examples. There are many others, but these are, I think, the major ones that causes burglary investigation to be a pretty rough deal. By the way, anytime there's questions, raise your hand, sound off, and I'll try to answer them. Basically, there are four types of burglars. First of all, there's what we call the hardcore professional. Now, basically, he's going to be a man who does not work. He wouldn't work if he had the chance. He spends most of his time either having a good time spending the money he's gotten through burglaries, or he's studying. And when I say study, I mean he's actually studying. He will get periodicals, manuals on safes, on locks, on keys, on radio equipment. And he will study this, and he'll study it real good, because he takes pride in the fact that he's an expert in his field. We've had situations here where they've gone out and committed a burglary primarily to get a hold of a door of a safe, and that's all they wanted. They got this door, they took it apart, studied it, studied the mechanism, the functioning of it, the type of metal, studied its weak points and its strong points. Now, those people are professionals, pure and simple. They spend a lot of time, a lot of effort to further their education in this particular field. The second type is what I like to term a random professional. He's an individual who's pretty intelligent. He's not going to devote his activities entirely to burglary alone. He may be employed. He may have a job. But he likes to have a little more money than what he's going to make on this job. And he likes to have an extra thrill once in a while. So periodically, when he needs a little money or when he gets tired of the routine of the job, he, along with some of his friends, are going to plan a special type of job to pull off. But it's not going to be a consistent, steady thing with him. But he's still a pretty capable man. He knows when he does go out, he knows what he's doing. The third type is what I call the opportunist. He's a burglar. He may be pretty good or he may not be so good. Usually, he will be employed in one manner or another. If he goes out in an evening, he doesn't generally go out with the intention of going on a burglary. He may go out to a beer tavern, meet some friends, they have a few drinks. And in the course of this, another fellow comes along and says, "Hi, Joe," and they sit down and they get to talking, and one of the fellows say, "I know a real good place to take tonight. They got a lot of dough there." So there's some discussion, they hash it over between themselves, and this fellow is there. He thinks, "Well, what the hell? I might as well make a little money too, get my cut." So he says, "Sure, I'll go along with you. It sounds good." That's the type of individual that I, as I say, call an opportunist. And the fourth type, and if there's any CPB people here tonight, this is what I call a juvenile burglar. He's the fellow under 18 who is a burglar, and he might actually be any one of the three other types that I mentioned. I think that most of you will recognize that we've got some boys, 16, even 15, 16, 17, who you might term to be a real hardcore professional, at least for his age. They do a pretty damn good job, and they commit a lot of them before they're caught. You've got the random professional there in the juvenile, the kid that's goes along with the rest of them because he figures, what the hell, I might as well go with my buddies and make a buck or two. And then you've got more or less the opportunist there also. In types of burglaries, there you're all familiar with this, I think. We break it down in two categories. One is the business burglary. Then we further subdivide that into burglaries of fur stores where the primary target is the expensive furs that they hope to get. The person that hits a store like this, he usually has a means of disposal already set up. The furs are rather hurriedly gotten out of town or at least gotten to a fence. They're put undercover. He gets his money and away he goes. Banks, which we don't have too much of here in Minneapolis, at least we haven't had in the recent past. Another type is the electrical appliance store. And there, as you all know, we get hit pretty hard. TVs, radios, and that sort of thing. And there again, most of these fellows already know where they're going to dispose of this. In fact, many times they've already taken a number of orders. They go around to different appliance stores until they find the brand that is carried that they know they can dispose of, that they've already got orders for. Another type, of course, is drug stores. And there, we've got some boys here tonight who are quite familiar with that aspect of it. You've got the young fellow who's a narcotic addict to some degree, some small degree, others greater. Their primary objective there is the narcotics, and of course they're going to rifle the till and sometimes take the save. Then we have the supermarkets. They're after two things, either merchandise in the form of cigarettes or the safe itself. We have churches, is another category, and there generally they will try to get the safe if they possibly can. Then there are the more or less general type, unclassified type of burglary of other stores and offices. This would be like filling stations, small grocery stores, and that type of thing. Warehouses, there again, they're generally after a specific item. They've cased it. They know what's in this warehouse. They figure out ways and means of getting in there. They plan their methods of hauling the loot. They might rent a truck. We've had several examples in the past here where they've rented Hertz trucks. They moved in and hauled whole truckloads out. And then, of course, superimposed over many of these is the safe burglar himself, who more or less specializes in safes. And, of course, he will hit any one of these type of stores wherever he thinks that there's enough money in the safe to make it worthwhile. In dwellings, we break it down into three categories. First is apartments. The second is single dwellings and duplexes. And the third is the home type of garage. Next, I'm going to list some reasons why we fail to solve burglaries. And as I go along here, I may step on some toes a little bit. And if so, it's done intentionally, because it applies to all of us, what I'm going to say. It applies to no matter what your position here in the police department, detective, patrolman, or what have you, it applies to all of us. And I think the first reason, the foremost one, is the failure to complete the crime scene search. And if you would take notes, write that down and underline it and underscore it again, because that is the biggest thing where we're falling down today, here in, at least here in our city. Another failure is that we're not utilizing scientific aids. Now, by that I mean the use of the Bureau of Identification, pictures, the search for prints, the search for other types of scientific evidence. We're sadly lacking in that today. There's reasons why. As you all know, they have the same problem that many other sections do, a shortage of funds. There may be other reasons, maybe a shortage of personnel. I think every section in the police department is short of personnel. But nevertheless, it's a very serious failure right here in our department. If we had adequate facilities, just that one thing alone would enable us to do a hell of a lot better job on our investigations. To give you an example, a man was arrested here, I think Saturday night, in a place. We charged him on Monday. Monday afternoon, we got a search warrant, went out and searched a car. We come up with a hell of a lot of other evidence. We dug out another safe job that had no connection with this case, and I called up the Bureau of Identification, and I found out that the safe on this other job had been recovered. I also was told that the individual who was aware of it at the time, which was on Sunday, had called up the Bureau of Identification, told him he wanted pictures. So I called up there to see if they'd taken pictures. No, they hadn't gone out. Now, there may have been reasons. I don't know. I didn't look into that aspect of it. But the fact remains is that in a day or two, we're going to go up to the county attorney's office, and we're going to want a complaint on this individual who's still at large. We know who he is. We know that he's been hitting a number of places. We know that he's pulled a number of safe jobs. It would be a hell of a nice thing if we could go up to county attorney and lay down the pictures where the safe was found, the conditions under which it was found, what it looks like, and we could show this to a jury. But we can't do it, and we never will be able to do it because the safe has been moved. All that evidence, the physical evidence at the scene, is gone, and we'll never get it. That's just one little example of what I mean by not having adequate scientific aids. Now, as I say, there's reasons why. There's a shortage of money, shortage of personnel. But it is a handicap. Another factor, and this applies to each and every one of us, and that's a lack of trained manpower. And I'm going to cite some examples. Number one under that is a failure to know the laws. The criminal statutes are our Bible. That's our set of tools. Just the same as the carpenter has his tool kit, he takes pretty damn good care of them. I think any carpenter that you ever heard of, he's pretty proud of his tools, and brother, you better not handle them and fool around with them, because that's the livelihood, that's what he makes his living by. The same thing with a mechanic. He has a toolbox probably that contains $500 worth of tools at the minimum. And he's pretty careful with that, because that's the tools of his trade. The criminal laws are the tools of our trade. But I think it would be interesting if we could make a survey in some manner and actually determine how many people in the whole police department actually know all the elements of the criminal laws that we function under every day. I think it would be very small. That's one of our big failures. We don't know them. Another factor under lack of trained manpower is the failure to follow departmental procedures. Now, you all know that periodically orders will come out, memorandums will come out suggesting a certain course of action. What you may not realize is that most of the time a great deal of thought goes into it before this memorandum or this order is published. First of all, a particular situation is analyzed to find out what's wrong. Next, if we find out what's wrong, then we sort of get our heads together and figure out what should be done, what can be done to correct this. The net result is it winds up in a directive or an order or a memorandum. It may last for 4 or 5 days, maybe at the most. Everybody forgets about it. Bear in mind that there's a reason, almost invariably, there's a reason and a good reason why these directives, these memorandums are put out. But that's one of the failures that we have. From talking with other departments, I guess the same thing exists there too. Every department, I think, is plagued with this sort of thing. Another factor under lack of trained manpower is a lack of interest. I think everyone in this room, I know I have, I've worked with partners who said, "Oh, to hell with it. I want to go and have a cup of coffee." Regardless of what type of call come over the radio or what other activity should be taken care of at the time, you run into this individual once in a while who's interested in going out and making a phone call or chatting with a girlfriend. Not that I'm against girlfriends. I think women are fine, but there's a time and a place for everything. But he just has a complete lack of interest. And if you'll all of you think back, you'll remember people that you've worked with sometime in the past who were just exactly like that. Another factor under the lack of trained manpower is improper reports and incomplete reports. There again, there have been memorandums published, directives published, but sometimes they're ignored. And as I say, it's not just a problem on our department alone. Down on my desk, I have a copy of a training bulletin put out by the Phoenix Police Department not too long ago. And in reading it over, I find out they've got the same damn problem we have. The reports are inadequate, they're improperly made out, they're incomplete. And it reflects itself when it comes time to run the investigation. And each and every one of you, when you get in the detective bureau, and it doesn't make any difference whether you come into burglary or some other division, You're going to be there for about 6 months, and you get some of these reports, and you're going to start cussing to beat hell. You're going to say, those guys, so-and-so, you know. You wait and see if you don't. I can stand here, and I know just as sure as I'm here that that's exactly what you're going to do. Another factor is the failure to understand the importance or the concept of judicial decisions. There's a hell of a lot of them coming out in the last year or two, all kinds from all sides. We're not keeping abreast of it, and when I say we, again, I'm including all of us in it. We have a problem where there's not even a complete accord between the various courts themselves, which makes it more difficult for us, naturally. But still, it's important that we do keep abreast of these court decisions and actually read and understand and know exactly what the court had in mind. Many times it takes a great deal of reading of each one of these decisions to fully understand what the thinking of the court was. In other words, exactly what did they say? What did they mean? These are important. And another major factor is the lack of essential equipment. There again, that applies to transportation for one thing. Everybody's short of cars. That goes back to an inadequate budget. We're short of other equipment. We're short of equipment to conduct surveillance activity. Surveillance is very important, especially in burglary investigation. But we don't have the type of vehicles needed. We don't have the type of communication equipment we need. These things take money. There's where we're handicapped. There's other types of equipment. And this again goes back to what I talked about, a lack of scientific aids. The Bureau of Identification is short of funds there for the equipment that they like to function with. But nevertheless, it's a very serious handicap. Again, there are others. But I think this covers it pretty well, gives you a general picture of the difficulties, or some of the difficulties, that we have to function under. Now, insofar as the burglary division is concerned, I think most of you have been dropped in there from time to time. You have an idea of how we're organized. But there's some here that I don't believe have been down there, so I'll go over it. We have 8 teams of detectives on the day shift. We have 5 teams on the afternoon shift and 1 on the dog watch. We have 7-day-a-week coverage, 24 hours a day. I'll have to make one exception to that. There's one day on the middle shift in the year that we don't have a burglary detective on duty. And that'll usually be sometime in December when we have our own division party, pre-Christmas party. Somebody else in the rest of the divisions take up the slack for us. But other than that, we have detectives on duty right around the clock throughout the year. We've analyzed our workload, and we found that the bulk of the investigation has to take place on the day shift. The reason being that the businesses are open during the daytime. These people are not available at night. Other offices, whether it's private or public, are open only in the daytime. Their records, their information is available only in the daytime. The county attorney's office is open only in the daytime. So the bulk of our activity does have to take place during the 8 hours on the day shift. And that's why we have the majority of our manpower functioning then. On certain types of dwelling burglaries, specifically apartment house burglaries, there we found that many of those It's more advantageous to handle them on the afternoon shift, because these people then are home from work and they are available to be contacted. So we break it down, we analyze our workload, we try to determine when is the best time to handle it from the standpoint of overall investigation. We have a team, as I said, on the dog watch all the time, 7 nights a week. They're there. They're available to be called for advice. And when you get into the detective bureau, you're going to find that you're going to be called. You're going to have squads call you. They have a situation that's unique. It's a little new to them. They're going to be calling you. They're going to expect that you're going to tell them what to do, what they should do, what they should not do, and how to do it many times. That's a part of your job as a detective. Sometimes they're going to put you on the spot. So I might say this to sergeants and future sergeants. Make use of these detectives on the dog watch. Call them whenever you think it's necessary and advisable. If it's merely a question of discussing a situation, trying to evaluate what is going to be the best course of action, most of the men will be very glad to help out insofar as they can. If there's a felony where there's an arrest made, they should be called in most cases. Because, as you all of you know, we are limited now as to how long we can hold a prisoner. And it's important that they get onto the case as soon as possible after it happens. The leads are still fresh. They can accomplish a lot, even though it's still on the dog watch. That's what we have these men there for. When you get in the bureau, that's what you'll be on the dog watch for, to give the assistance that is necessary and to immediately jump into the investigation and start operating on it right away. Are there any questions occur to anybody so far? Yes.
This order that came out today, this memorandum on stopping a vehicle, a felony has been committed, go through the car, rip the trunk apart. How do you ever come to the exact conclusion that you can go into the trunk even if it was locked? And
what are you going to do if you make a valid arrest on reasonable cause for a man to be committed a felony? There may well be some evidence in that trunk. What are you going to do with it? Are you going to throw it away, forget about it? You're a policeman. You damn well hadn't better. You're going to try to get into that trunk without breaking it open, yes. You're going to try to get the keys. The guy is already under arrest, so you've searched him already. Now, logically, if you took him out of the car, he's going to have keys to it. So generally, you're not going to have to break in. But, I said, if necessary, you will break in, because you're not going to pass up any evidence, if necessary.
It won't be an illegal search or seizure.
Not if you've made a valid arrest, and if your search is incidental to the arrest. We're going to cover that a little while later, and I expect we'll have...
time element on that is a hell of a...
That's right. We're going to come to that here. I've got the court decisions right here. We're going to... I think the second hour we'll get into a hot and heavy session on that. And I might say now in advance that, and I learned it from last night, some of you have taken notes from a lecture, I guess, that occurred last week, and I'll warn you right now, I'm going to disagree with him, and I'll continue to disagree with him, and I'll back it up too. All right, this may be a lot of repetition for you, but I think it's important, I think it's necessary as detectives that you sit down and review the crimes themselves. As I said before, it's what you're working with every day. It's your Bible, it's your set of tools. Let's take the statute on burglary. Now, you'll find it at every station. It's in this type of gray book, I believe. Have you all seen this book somewhere in your station? It should be there. And you'll find that most of the divisions are Their method of operations generally are set down here, and you'll find that the crimes that they're primarily concerned with are also listed. And in the burglary here, first of all, in this section, in this chapter, it starts out with definitions. And definitions on these crimes are important because it helps you analyze the balance of the statute. Without knowing the definitions and what the legislature has said the legal meaning of these words are, you cannot properly evaluate this whole statute. The first definition that is covered here has to do with the entry to the building. And I'm going to read it. And it says, whoever enters a building while open to the general public does so with consent, except when, prior thereto, consent is expressly withdrawn. The reason they put in this definition is because they have specified that one of the elements of the crime of burglary is what is called unauthorized entry. And here this definition says all entries into a building while open to the public will be with consent unless it is expressly withdrawn beforehand. So what we have here is that and it has occurred, although we haven't had a great deal of problem in court because we never got that far with these cases. But we get an individual that goes in a business place and hides in there, goes in while it's still open for business. He hides in there, maybe goes down the basement. They lock up, they go home. He commits the burglary or he commits the theft or whatever he intended to do in there. Then he breaks out. Now, that's a loophole, and so far as I'm concerned, in our statutes, we have nothing to cover that. Because he entered, as far as the definition here is concerned, he entered with consent. Therefore, it is not an unauthorized entry. In the statutes in Illinois and Wisconsin, which were revised about a year before ours were, they have express provision for that. And that is expressly stated in their statutes, that type of action is also burglary. But we do not have it here. And when that situation occurs, then we've got to take some other course of action. We've got to try to find some other statute that is going to cover the situation. It might be theft. It might be some other statute. It means that we've got to search for it, try to find something that will fit the particular set of facts that we do have at that time. I don't know. You'd have to go to the people that drafted this thing. It was in the old statutes. It was covered there. But we don't have it here. And the second definition is that of a building. And it says here that the building includes a dwelling or other structure suitable for affording shelter for human beings or appurtenant to or connected with a structure so adapted, and includes portion of such structure as are separately occupied. Now, you'll notice in analyzing this that it's specifically applying to dwellings. So you wonder, where do we have, where is a business place? How can that be burglary? There we have to go back to previous court decisions. There has been court decisions that says the telephone company over here is housed in a building. They classify it as a commercial building. It's not in our statute expressly, but we have to go back to previous court decisions to bring this type of situation into the statute on burglary. Before we get into the actual acts of burglary, let's take we'll continue on with a discussion of the statute on burglary here. I'm going to cover it rather hurriedly because there's a lot more material that I want to get across, but it is important enough that I think that we should spend a little time on it. In the second subdivision of the burglary statute, it has to do with acts constituting burglary. And here's where we come into some more elements of the crime. And the first section under subdivision 2 has to do with what we term 20-year burglary. And this first section says that when entering or while in the building, the individual possesses an explosive or a tool to gain access to money or property. All right, what do we have to have then? First of all, we've got to have an unauthorized entry. We've got to prove that. Next, we've got to charge him under this section. We've got to prove that he had possession of some tools that he brought with him that were designed to pry open a safe or pry open a cash register or something like that. And if he isn't caught with these tools right on him, we have kind of a rough time trying to prove that. So in so many cases, we have to drop down to the 5-year burglary because we can't prove the elements under this one. The next section there, it says the building entered is a dwelling and he possesses a dangerous weapon when entering or while in the building, or he commits an assault upon a person present therein. Here brings some more elements into the picture. You got to go back to the original, the unauthorized entry. In other words, he did not have permission to go in there. We have to prove that. Next, we have to prove that he had a dangerous weapon on him when he entered. All right, what we may have to do is go back and search some law to find out exactly what, under the law, a dangerous weapon is. In different situations, it might be different objects. What might be a dangerous weapon to me would not be to you. Or what might be a dangerous weapon to all of us, the court might say, no, that isn't a dangerous weapon under the law. Or he commits an assault upon a person present. That's another element. All right, going back to some cases that we're still having, we had a lot of them when Gossett was around. He was committing a burglary. He was committing an unauthorized entry. Generally, he didn't have a weapon when he entered. At least there was no proof of that. But he did commit assaults upon the people once he got in there. In some cases, he actually raped the women. In other cases, he committed other types of indecent assaults. So basically, what he was doing was committing 20-year burglary. And what isn't generally known throughout the department as a whole, and it's not known in the Bureau of Records, is the fact that under this statute here, that carries a heavier penalty than what rape does. Because rape of a woman, I think over, I'd have to go back and check that now, but I think it's over 23, carries 7 years. And this carries 20. And yet most of those cases come in entitled rape. Why? Primarily because somebody didn't know the elements of the crimes. They didn't know the Bible they work with. The third factor, and this doesn't apply to what it's never happened to my knowledge, or at least we've never been able to use it, but I'll read it. The portion of the building entered contains a banking business or other business of receiving securities or other valuable papers for deposit or safekeeping. And the entry is with force or threat of force, the intent is to steal or commit a felony therein. As I say, we've never had, to my knowledge at least, we've never had occasion to use this particular section.
Wouldn't the post office come under that one?
No. Their business is not primarily to conduct a banking business or maintain securities as such. We've handled some post office investigations here, and the county attorney has checked this section, and he has said that he didn't think it applied. And therefore, yes?
Is the intent only in the banking business? You don't have to have an intent in the dwelling or
I'm going to come to intent. I'm saving that to last because that's the best and the hardest. Then we drop down after we have these three sections to what is called, what I call, 10-year burglary. And again, this is pertains to a dwelling. And it says, if another person, not as accomplice, is present therein. In other words, if an individual goes into a dwelling, makes an unauthorized entry, and there's somebody in this dwelling at the time, he isn't armed with a dangerous weapon, he does not commit any assault, it's still, under this section, is 10-year burglary. If there is a person in there at the time. Then the third section is, in any other case, to imprisonment for not more than 5 years, or payment of a fine of not more than $5,000, or both, if the intent is to steal or commit a felony or a gross misdemeanor. And there's where, because of the difficulty of approving all of the elements involved, quite frequently we have to drop down to this last section and charge them. Now, superimposed over all of the other elements, or in addition to, I should say, is the element of intent. And in every criminal statute, I don't know of a one where you are not required to prove intent. And in burglary, in every phase of it, we must prove intent. And it's tough to do. Almost invariably, we've got to prove it circumstantially. Because a time was when we used to get a lot of admissions and the guy says, yeah, I went in there to steal so-and-so. But now with the, again, going back to the recent decisions of the various courts, we're limited on interrogation. These characters all know their full rights. The attorneys hop down right away and say, shut up and don't say a word. So how are we going to prove intent if we don't have their admission? We've got to go at it indirectly. We've got to have every last detail of evidence. We've got to have a complete and thorough crime scene search. We've got to have all the physical evidence that we could possibly get. We've got to build this up step by step by step. We've got to go to a jury, present all of this, and let the jury come to a decision as to whether or not by all these series of facts that we presented, they draw the conclusion that this individual had the intent to commit a crime. And it's not easy. And when you get in the bureau, you're going to find the same thing. It's damn tough. Are there any questions on this so far?
The time has nothing to do with this anymore then?
No, that's
day or night.
That was under the old statute, and that is no longer... We no longer have to be concerned. It's whether it's daytime or nighttime, it's still burglary, if the other elements are there. Yes?
The fact that the theft occurs during a burglary is intent, however.
That helps a great deal, yes. But suppose we get and it happens all the time, fellows are caught right in there before they have a chance, they don't get anything in their pocket. And he says, as many of you probably here have heard him say to you, well, I was pretty drunk. I didn't know I was inside here. Or some of them say, well, I saw this broken window and I crawled in to look around and then I was going to call the police. I wanted to get to the phone. What are you going to do?
I agree. What I'm thinking of is in terms of if you can...
Yes, if... All right. Now you're getting into the point of the crime scene search, the search of the individual, and all of the little details of physical evidence that we have to have to build up the fact that this individual did take something in there. That's a good big step toward proving intent. And I'll tell you a little story of what happened, right in line with what you're saying. This was about a year ago. The officer on the dog watch was patrolling his beat and doing a good job. He was walking the alleys and so forth. And as he come up to this place, the burglar jumped out of the back door and started to run up the alley, and the officer right after him. And while he was running, he discarded some of the loot, cigarettes and so forth. The officer caught him, brought him down, booked him, picked up the evidence, the loot that he threw away, that was inventory. He made his report. The next morning we got the report, and in the list of loss there, they reported a monetary loss of, $29, I think it was, and 32 cents. So we found the other evidence, and we started looking for the money. We looked, they checked in the uniform captain's office. We checked all over the whole headquarters. We called out the station. Wasn't around any place. And we checked with the owner, and he says, yes, that's what I lost in money. So about 10 of 30, we were trying to figure out that morning where in the hell this money was. Because we knew that this man was in sight of the officer all the time. I mean, he hadn't got around a corner where he could have thrown it and the officer didn't see it. So finally, I told the detectives to go upstairs, get this guy out of the cell and go through his pockets. They went up there, they come back. They were carrying a little sack. What'd you find? We found $29.32 right here in his front pocket. Well, now the guy was stupid. Why didn't he get rid of that? Give it to some of the other prisoners. Throw it over in the next cell. And if that happened now, none of that would be admissible as evidence because it would have been now an illegal search. None of that would have been admissible. But it helped to prove the element, one of the important elements of the crime at that time.
Hey, Captain?
Yeah.
To make a 10-year burglar, this occupant of a dwelling, has the court ruled at all as to where this occupant of the dwelling, not an accomplice, could be, like on the third floor or the fourth floor, as compared to the burglary taking place in the basement?
No, there are no, there's no decisions that I know of. I think what you'd have to do is go back to determine what constitutes a dwelling. Now, an apartment, it would not be the whole building. In other words, if an individual was in apartment 6 and the burglary occurred in apartment 5, it would not be applicable. If it's a single dwelling, I think the individual being, let's say the burglar was in on the ground floor and the individual was in a bedroom or something, I think that would apply.
On the same floor, or it could be on the second floor?
Well, I think it would even on the second floor, very likely. Now, I don't know because it's never come up. But I would say that it would be the dwelling itself. What would be legally constituting the dwelling?
The domicile of the one resident.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. A duplex, for example, if the burglary occurred downstairs, the person was in the section upstairs, it would not apply. Now, there are other statutes that we make use of quite a bit. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail on them because they're in the book here. You should read them, but I'm just going to comment on them. One of them is the possession of burglary tools. Now, that is something that is being overlooked a lot. There's some cities that have cleaned up a hell of a lot of burglary gangs just by stressing this particular statute in their state laws. And one of the reasons why we're missing a bet on this is because there's a lot of confusion in the minds of people out on the street, including detectives and police officers, as to what constitutes reasonable cause to make an arrest without a warrant. Time after time after time, night after night, individuals are being stopped. The officers are looking at things. They're not recognizing it, what they're seeing, or they're hesitating because they're unsure. So they say, give me your name and address and go on about your business. We're missing a big bet on that. It's something that we can do a lot of good with if we can just get everybody to understand all the basic principles involved. Another one is receiving stolen property. We try to use that whenever we can. Sometimes if we can't charge burglary, we'll drop down to that one. We'd like to use it on fences as much as possible because if we can break up a fence, it's just going to handicap the burglar that much more. But that's a kind of a tough one to prosecute under. Another statute that's real good if we can't go any other way, and that's criminal damage to property. Now, that's a new title. Under the old statute, it used to be called vandalism. But here it's called criminal damage to property, and it's divided into two sections. One makes it a misdemeanor. The other section makes it a felony, the distinction being that the elements are different. A number of times we haven't been able to go burglary, so we've used this statute here and charged him with a felony. And the felony section carries 5-year penalty. So read that, be familiar with it, know what the elements are, because many times you may, if you're not aware of it and not familiar with it, you're not going to put down the facts in the report that would help us to make use of it. Well, those are the basic ones that we use in burglary. And as I say, go to the book, read it, study it, ask questions. If there's some sections you're not sure of, give somebody a call, the county attorney, call us. If we don't know the answer, we'll try to find out. Well, next we go to some of the objectives that we have there in burglary. This is going to be rather general, but it'll outline some of the basic principles of our operation. Number one, we try to develop evidence to prove the elements of the crime. And all the way through here, you have to keep in mind the elements of the crime. You've got to prove them. You've got to have facts to substantiate it. And if you can't prove one of the three basic elements that are required in the statute, then you cannot charge burglary. You can't just have proof for two and get by. It's got to be proof for all three at a minimum. If you can't prove that, you've got to go then some other way or else kick him loose, which we had to do to a couple guys today, and it hurt like hell, but we had to turn them loose. Number two, by proving these, developing facts to prove the elements of the crime, these facts are going to lead us to the identity of the suspects. Once we know the identity of the suspects and have the facts to prove the element of the crime, then next comes the apprehension of the suspects. Then, of course, after that, the filing of charges, getting complaints, and following that, testimony in court to get convictions. Or rather, I take that back. Testimony in court to present the facts. On the actual investigation of burglary itself, I kind of go for definitions every once in a while, as you've already noticed tonight. And I'm going to give you another one. It's the process of tracing or tracking down the details of an incident by systematic search and patient inquiry. It entails skillful observation and examination of facts. It entails systematic attention to detail. And detail is a little word, but in this investigation, it means a great deal. It's a big one. Detail, detail, detail. I can't stress that enough. Therefore, a police investigation is the critical search for truth and information, the gathering of facts and data, and the application of techniques to affect the desired results. In other words, the resolving of the case, the apprehension of the suspect. From there, then, we go to the preliminary investigation. It doesn't make any difference whether you're a detective in a squad or if you're in the office or whether you're a patrolman in a car. The minute you get a call on a burglary, you're involved in this investigation. You're a member of an investigating team. patrolman, sergeant, what have you, detective, it's immaterial. The minute you get this call, you become a member of a team investigating this burglary. It becomes a continuing investigation. You get the initial call. You start toward the address. You should start observing things right off the bat. First of all, you want to jot down in your notebook certain data, the time you got the call, what type of information that you got. Was it a burglary in progress? Was it information from a citizen? What is the nature of this call that you get from the dispatcher? That's very important in making your subsequent report. Keep alert to cars coming toward you. This may be the burglars leaving the scene. Maybe they heard the call go out and they're getting the hell out of there. Notice these cars as they're going by. How many people are in the car? Try to get the license number, the color of the car. Make a note of the time you saw it, the location where you saw it, the corner or whatever it might be. When you get there, generally your first action is going to be to check the place to see if there's anybody in there. And again, depending upon the nature of your call, if it's a burglary in progress, you're going to surround the place, contain it, until you can get somebody to open it up to get in there and search the place. All right, you've done these things. You've arrived. Then starts a very important thing, and that's the crime scene search. And if you remember, I said earlier here in the first hour that that was one of our biggest weaknesses. That's where we're all falling down. First of all, you get there, you should make an immediate appraisal of the thing. You've got to establish, is there a break-in? Is there a burglary? How are you going to start out doing that? First of all, you're going to determine the method of entry, because this has a bearing on proving unauthorized entry, which is one of the elements of the crime. Second, you want to determine the method of entry because very frequently there's going to be some type of physical evidence that might be there. It might be blood. It might be some blood on broken glass. It might be fingerprints on some glass. It might be fingerprints inside of the window as he reached in to pull himself through. It might be some hair. It might be some item that dropped out of his pocket that would lead to the identity of the individual. Not long ago, there might be somebody here that worked on that. We had a burglar went in through the skylight. And when he was coming down from the skylight down the rope, I don't know what happened, whether he slipped, but in a way, a billfold and slipped out of his pocket. And apparently he didn't notice it. And it laid there on the floor and it was found later. And this billfold very conveniently contained his identification, his parole papers, and the whole damn works. That made it real nice. All of these things are physical evidence. So first of all, check your method of entry. While you're doing that, you're going to look for other things. You're going to look for tool marks. So you find tool marks on the door. In your report, are you just going to say, yeah, there was some pry marks on the door? Unfortunately, that's what some of these reports say. That isn't enough. That's only the beginning. We want to know what type of pry mark. How big was it? How wide was it? You should carry in your pocket. You can get one of these steel rules that's graduated in a rather fine graduation. Measure this mark. That's very important to us to know exactly how wide, how deep this mark was, how many of these marks were on the door, what location were they? Were they up about 4 feet from the lock, or were they down near the lock? If they were up at the top, that would be a silly way to try to break in. Maybe it's somebody just simulating a burglary. That's important to know. Along with other facts, we want to be able to evaluate it. We want to come to a conclusion as to whether or not this guy is just filing a false report and made some pry marks and so forth to make it look like a legitimate deal. And that happens. It happens more than what you might think. Look for broken glass. Examine it with your flashlights. There may be nothing on it, but there may well be some prints. When you find something in the way of physical evidence, make a note of exactly where you find it. Then mark it so that you can identify it later. And don't destroy evidence. We had a case one time. This is a dwelling. The officers that answered the call, they went there and they did a pretty good job. The woman said they were very nice, very courteous. They were talked intelligently. They were well-dressed. Their clothing was neat and clean. But it happens that one of the officers, this woman had a glass vase, and it was rather unique design. And while the officer was there, he reached down, he picked it up and looked at it, admired it, and he says, "My wife just loves this kind of thing, and she's got one just about like it." He sets it back down, goes on about his business. So when our men were out later talking to this woman, she says, "Oh, by the way," she says, "I just before the burglary, I had cleaned this vase, washed it, and wiped it off," and she said, "I hadn't handled it since." So she says, "And it was moved when I got in here and found the burglary," so she says, "there might well be some prints on it." So we brought it down. Sure, there were prints, just as beautiful as you could want. Unfortunately, there were two sets of prints, but one set of prints was superimposed over the others, and the officers were on top. It just happened. It was one of those sheer accidents that the officer apparently had picked it up in the same manner the burglar had, and his prints